Where does your voice come from?
I think my voice, I mean, if we're talking about the sort of the voice of my poems, the way that my speaker speaks, comes partly at least from things that I've been told not to do in poetry. And I feel like forever throughout my life as a poet, I'm the type of person who, if you tell me not to do something, I will find a way to do it. But I want to do it well so that I can prove that the person who told me not to do it was wrong, right? I don't want to do it and fail because that would just mean that I should take advice better. So a lot of things like using adjectives, for example. I mean, particularly when I was in the MFA a long time ago, adjectives were very much out of fashion, and with good reason, because if you have the most precise noun and verb, then you more likely don't need an adjective. On the other hand, something that was really fun, particularly in the book, has been sort of putting them back in and realizing that that's a voice issue as much as it is an issue of precision of language. So I can be precise in my language and I can choose to layer some adjectives. So that's been fun. Voice, like speaking voice, came from North Carolina.
Hello and welcome to The Right Question, a radio program and podcast featuring authors from the Western United States. Our funding comes from Humanities Montana and members of Montana Public Radio. I'm Sarah Aronson, talking with poet Henrietta Goodman about her collection of 48 linked Italian sonnets, All That Held Us, winner of the John Ciardi Prize from Bookmark Press. This program does contain brief adult language.
What's funny to me is my other first question for you was, how are you rebellious in your poetry?
Oh.
And I think you just answered
it. We covered
it.
That. Oh, well, there is another thing, though, that I think I don't know if it's being rebellious, but it's something that I try to do. I was in a coffee shop downtown a few days ago, and the girl working, she rang me up, and I paid, and I was waiting for my coffee, and then she said, "Are you a poet?" And I said, "Yeah, I am, actually." And she said, "Do you have a poem about a placenta?" And I said, "I do. How do you know that?" And she had been in Robert Stubblefield's Montana Writers Live class when I came and spoke to them a few years ago. And I thought it was awesome that she remembered that poem, because I do think that, you know, when I wrote that poem, I was very aware that it was either going to be easy to publish or very difficult to publish, because it was about I don't even know if it's a body part, a temporary and disposable body part, which is part of what the poem was exploring. I really love it when poets are able to write about things that we would think of as being absolutely outside the realm of poetry. There's a poem by Bill Winthy about having a colonoscopy. There's a poem by Charles Bukowski about going to the hospital to have his boils on his face lanced. And so I've always really been drawn to those topics that people might say, like this young woman in Liquid Planet said, "Oh, this really made me sort of think about things I could write about in a different way." And I thought, perfect. That's great. That's exactly what I wanted. That might be being rebellious, too.
This collection of poems has been described as dominoes, a garland, necklace, rosary, prayer flags. Daisy chains and gears turning came to mind for me. But I want to know, how do you describe this collection visually?
Visually, it looks a little odd because it's odd formally. The reason that it's described in all of those ways that suggest connection between the poems is that it is a collection of linked Italian sonnets. So each poem takes up the previous one by repeating a little piece of a line, or sometimes even a whole line. So it's nothing so ambitious as a crown of sonnets, which would be where whole lines are repeated, and then after 14 of them, you have a whole 15th poem made out of those whole lines from the 14 previous poems. That's incredible. I didn't do that. But I did link them, so I didn't individually title them, which means, to go back to the question of how the book looks visually, my publisher had a really neat idea to put the first line of each poem up in the header. So I wouldn't have thought of that, but it kind of gives each poem a title. It's not a running header. The page numbers are, of course, there, and then the title is popped up. But it does make it a little easier to find each poem, because what I've noticed is that even, you know, if I'm not reading straight through and I'm flipping through at a reading, then I'm like, which poem is that? Where is that in the book? Which is not the way you want to feel when you're doing a reading and trying not to shuffle papers. So it could look a little more accessible on the page, I guess.
So I want to get the mathematics out of the way. Can you just define the Italian sonnet in terms of stanza and line level and level of meter and rhyme?
Sure. So all sonnets have 14 lines. So the Italian sonnet has 14 lines. And there are two major varieties of sonnets. There's the English sonnet and the Italian sonnet. And they differ by rhyme scheme. So what I'm doing in these 14-line poems is a rhyme scheme that, if we were to label it, it would go ABBA, ABBA. That's the first 8 lines, which means you have basically 2 rhyme sounds that are each repeated 4 times, which means that, you know, if you pick a word that doesn't have good rhymes, then, you know, you might start over. Then after that, that's the octave. That's the first 8 lines. Then there's a rhyme shift, and then you have some options for how you rhyme the last 6 lines. Mine are rhyme CDE, CDE, but sometimes they're rhyme CD, CDEE, or sometimes they're rhymed a different way. It's a nice moment when you finish that first 8 lines and you realize you can say whatever you want in the next line. It's like, oh, okay, good. Now it's kind of starting over. And that's what we call the turn in the sonnet, because usually corresponding with that shift in the rhyme, there's also a shift in perspective or outlook or attitude or something there. So then the last 6 lines are the sestet. So that's the rhyme. And then you also have iambic meter, which basically means that each line has 10 syllables, and there's an alternation of stressed and unstressed syllables. Just like our heart goes along, da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da, that's what iambic meter does. I went to town and bought a cup of tea. That would be iambic rhythm, da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da.
One of the things I admire so much about you is that you call this type of hard work fun. And I just want to have you read one of your poems.
Sure. Well, the book is a memoir, and I guess I should say before I read this first poem that I had what I think is an unusual upbringing. I grew up in an all-female household. It was not some sort of idyllic, matriarchal, deliberate all-female household. It was just a house where I lived with my mother and her sister, my aunt, and their mother. Kind of Southern, if you're thinking of sort of repressive and weird and eccentric, then Southern in that way, yes. So the book kind of explores that and then looks at that in the context of, you know, moving on through the poems in the context of more adult relationships and how, what the impact of that unusual upbringing has been on me as an adolescent and an adult. This poem that I'm about to read takes place in early adolescence. The only thing I think I need to explain is pronouns. The they that comes in the first line is my mother and my aunt. I think everything else should be pretty self-explanatory. It wasn't innocent the way they mocked each other, screeched and grumbled a grammar of perfect bitterness, wore it, armor of status, even though my mother hawked her rings in Charlotte. So easily shocked, my aunt had packed away the old glamour of dances, sweat-stained dresses, the clamor for a partner. She sprayed Lysol and locked her door when my friends came, called me the child in notes she wrote to God or no one, scraps of paper buried under piles of stuff. I called her Head once at 13, wild to separate myself, to spring the traps, to find out whether words would be enough.
The form just carries the work. And I just want to know, how did you know that these poems needed to be in sonnet? And did you ever get fatigued? Because there are 48 of them.
Well, that's a really good question. I never thought of myself as a formalist at all. In fact, I remember very clearly being a young MFA student years ago and being told that iambic meter was very natural and that it was, you know, that's why it's so dominant in poetry. And I thought, oh, that's ridiculous. It doesn't come naturally to me at all. And of course, after writing 48 of these, there was, for a time, it was coming so naturally to me that I was like, make it stop. I need some assignments to sort of get me away from that, because I was even thinking iambically at that point. But these came about by accident. I've always been very interested in form, maybe because it's, again, to go back to that notion of rules about, you know, what we should or shouldn't write about or what we should or shouldn't do in a poem. And because form didn't come naturally to me, I wanted to try to master various poems just to sort of say, ha, I did it. A few years ago, a friend of mine gave me an assignment to write a poem in terza rima, which is another form that I had never tried. And so then I started thinking, what other forms have I not tried? And I realized I'd never tried the Italian sonnet, so I wrote one, and that is the first one that's in the book. And then I realized after that I was quite proud of myself, because I had, the word that ended the first line was the word physique, and I thought, wow, I just rhymed four times on that sound, and physique is a weird word. So I thought, okay, this one's good. I can do this. But what I also realized is that the subject that I had stumbled upon in that first attempt was a subject that I had never written about, which was my upbringing. And so I wanted to explore it more. So I wrote another one. Then I wanted to keep going. So I wrote another one. And then I got to a point where I thought, I don't know what the heck I'm doing, but I either need to keep doing it or I need to stop, because this is too weird to be part of a book. Mm-hmm. So I'm either writing a book or I'm just kind of experimenting, and this is going to be a throwaway. What I also started to think about, though, while I was thinking about those things, was the way that when we have chaotic subject matter, we can often sort of use form to control the chaos a little bit. And also the idea that, given the fact that I was writing in a semi-confessional mode, which is out of fashion right now, I wanted to make sure that I was doing that in a way that couldn't be disregarded. And so thinking sort of about both of those things, the way that formal structure can help us to write about personal things, and also the way that doing something impressive with form might sort of shift the reader's perspective of the subject matter in a way. So I had those two thoughts in mind, and that kind of kept me going. I didn't really get tired of writing the sonnets, but I definitely was happy to feel done and to move on to something else.
And you've mentioned the confessional nature of the body of work. Will you read the first poem in the third section, which is titled Which Way I Flew?
Sure. I think this one's pretty self-explanatory too. Although I do, in the first line, I mentioned getting sextoned up, and in that line, I'm referring to the poet Anne Sexton, who is a poet whose work I like very, very much, and she wrote in the confessional mode. By this time, this is the third section of the book. At that point, I was well aware of what I was doing, pretty aware, and the fact that I was digging into some pretty deeply confessional territory. Yeah. That night I got all sextoned up, red lips, a vintage polka-dotted dress, rhinestone earrings. Single at 43, I'd grown volition finally and learned to sip a drink. And when I stood, hand on my hip, to read these poems behind the microphone, a man in the back row whispered, "She's fine." And it was true, this dress mine to unzip or not, this story too. An older man asked later if I'd ever tried to write something positive about my father. And while I wondered if he meant certain or nice, he asked, "Didn't I think it might be therapeutic?" So this, my answer.
If you're just joining us, that's Henrietta Goodman reading from her collection of sonnets, All That Held Us, winner of the John Ciardi Prize for Poetry. I'm Sarah Aronson. This is The Right Question. Our full conversation can be found online at mtpr.org, where you can also subscribe to our podcast and follow us on Facebook. Stay tuned to hear a new poem from Henrietta, inspired by those backyard hens.
The encounter you describe feels so real to me, and I want to know about the permission that you have to use this voice. That when a man confronts you, you know, at a reading and says, "Are you going to write something nice about your dad?" that you turn it into a poem and then you say, "And here's my answer."
Well, that was tricky because I think the several poems, I was at the Atlantic Center for the Arts, and I had been working on the middle section of the book, and that is the section that really does try to speculate about what the relationship between my parents might have been like. My father figures more prominently in that section than in the other two sections. My main concern in writing this book was the fact that it portrays my mother in a somewhat critical way. And so that was much, much more at the foreground of my awareness. It's true that the poems that this man that I mentioned in the poem had heard me read don't necessarily portray my father in a positive way, but I don't think they portray him in a negative way either. He's a big absence. He's a question mark. I mean, clearly it would have been better had that not been the case, but because the relationship that I had with my mother was much more intimate, then there was a lot more room there for me to analyze and criticize. And so did I feel that I had permission to do that? No, not really. Did I do it anyway? Yeah. And I still feel somewhat conflicted about it, but I did it anyway.
When I first encountered the poems of this collection, they were titled All That Held Them. And now it appears in print as All That Held Us. And obviously there's been a closing in the distance of the title. And I want to know about the title change and what it represents to you.
Well, the title change wasn't my idea. All That Held Them is a line or a part of a line from one of the poems. And it was a kind of a placeholder title. I thought, well, this might do. I liked the idea of held implying both something positive to be held, but also something negative to be held back or to be held captive. So that part of the original title I liked. And I also liked the word them, because part of this book has been a process of figuring out them versus me and not including myself in them and not wanting to. As the poem was going into the publication stages, we were looking for a more engaging title because both the publisher and I agreed that All That Held Them was not particularly engaging. And I really wanted the title Escapology, which is the sort of the science of escape. That term appears in one of the poems too. It's a term that I learned in the process of writing the poem. I worked in a magic store when I was in college, and there was a table of death right inside the door. So in a sort of a Houdini style trick, a person would be bound in this table of death that had these giant iron spikes and would have to escape. So that process of and knowledge of how to escape would be escapology. I thought, oh, this is wonderful. And the publisher didn't like it because it was maybe cheesy or something. I don't know. So they suggested All That Held Us. And I thought, okay, fine. If we can't have escapology, and then let's have this. That's okay. So it was not really my deliberate change to the title. And it still kind of feels like a placeholder to me, but I don't mind it. I don't love it like I did escapology, though.
I want to hear what two poems sound back to back so that we can get a sense of their overlapping nature. Will you read the last two poems from the section, the middle section, Where She Stopped?
Okay, so these are the last two poems in the middle section, and that's the section that is kind of exploring what my parents' relationship might have been like. So this first one, the next to last one in this middle section, is taking up something that the poem before it starts to explore, which is these kind of extravagant but impractical presents that my father gave both to my mother and to me as a baby. So the it that I start off talking about is this terrible coat, which I think is explained in the poem. It would be mine, that coat she'd never worn. I petted it. The glossy swirls of wool had yellowed like old teeth. To age, awful enough, but worse to age like this, unborn, a fleece first drenched in blood, then rinsed, not shorn, but skinned. Like all his gifts, impractical, extravagant. For me, at 4, a pearl necklace. For him, easier to adorn than love. And so the coat, a golden fleece. And so the necklace broke, the pearls rolled, lost. If guilt's the opposite of innocence, then what's experience? And what release in silence or in song? We learn the cost and pay it, whether for greed or penance. And then this is the last one in the first section. To age, awful enough, but worse, not to resist. When I was 5, she did one thing without me. She took off her wedding ring, put on a dress her mother bought, a new pair of heels. Or maybe the same flat shoes she always wore, and maybe, too, the ring, the undershirt. I might remember wrong, or I made that mother up, swirls of blue and green across the flared ivory skirt, the sleeveless top. 25 years before, most likely to succeed. Why go, if not to prove she did, to see who's fat, to flirt with restless men? Why go single and poor, if not to be the girl that time forgot?
There's something that I find in your presence and your work that feels both shy and very bold, like petticoats and motorcycle boots, or like innocence and guilt. Where does the contrast come from in you?
I love that question because it's something that I think about a lot. And maybe it is present in the poems. It's certainly present in me as a person. I think partly because the people that I grew up with were fairly socially awkward and fairly isolated. I mean, when I say that this was a household with no men, I mean, this was not just a household with no men living in the house. This was, my mother never went on a single date throughout my entire life. She had no male friends. I mean, we had neighbors, of course, that we would see when we were out walking around the neighborhood. My aunt had never married. My grandfather, my grandmother's husband, had died before I was born. So there were literally no relationships, whether those were friendships or romantic relationships, that I really observed and could use as models for either how I would comport myself or you know, what I didn't want to be like. And really very few relationships at all to observe other than the ones taking place right in my household. So I was very, very, very shy as a child. I was afraid of boys and men, not afraid of being hurt by them, but just afraid of them because they were the other. I mean, they are the other in some ways, but for me, even more so because I simply was never around them. I was terribly shy. As I've gotten older, I've become much less so. In fact, a few years ago, I took one of those quizzes online to determine whether one is an introvert or an extrovert. And I was very, very proud of the fact that, according to this quiz, I'm 51% extrovert. And I do feel that I am. And I wonder a lot about nature versus nurture, not just for me, of course, but for everyone. I think we all wonder about it. So I still am quite shy in a lot of situations, but I also am very proud of myself for developing the social skills that I think a lot of children develop without having to think about it because it's being modeled for them. I went to school. It's not like I was completely isolated, but I was also very inwardly focused. And so as an adult, I think I had to consciously observe and imitate those social behaviors that maybe others have just internalized without having to think about it. So I think I'm there. I think I've done it, and I'm conscious of it and quite proud of it.
There is an internal soundtrack to the book, given that it's in the I Am. What would you like to see if you could add like a symphonic soundtrack to this book? What kind of band would you want to be playing?
Oh, my goodness. Let's see. All I can think of for that is I grew up in the 80s And so there are, especially in the last section of the book, references to bands and musicians that were very important to me. I was very, very, very interested in music as a teenager. There's a poem where I talk about Paul Westerberg, who was the singer and songwriter for the band The Replacements. He is just the absolute best ever. So I would definitely have a lot of Replacement songs playing in the background. There's a poem that mentions the band The Smiths. So there'd have to be a little of that. There are some other references to popular music, especially throughout that last section. So I would look through and pick different songs for each section. I'm not sure so much about the first two. That would be a fun thing to think about more.
What are you working on next?
Ooh, so I'm working on another project dealing with form, but in a very different way. After I wrote all of these sonnets, I mentioned that it was kind of difficult to stop writing sonnets. So I asked a friend of mine to start giving me some poem assignments to sort of force me not to write sonnets. And so we corresponded back and forth for a while doing that. And then back around Thanksgiving, so maybe, when was Thanksgiving? 6 or 8 months ago, he said, hey, okay, I have this idea for this collaborative project. We can write an alphabet of animal acrostic poems. I was like, wait, what? We're gonna write what? Acrostic poems, of course, when we hear the term, if we have prior experience with it, we usually think of those poems that children write in kindergarten or first grade where they put a word down the margin of a page, and then usually it's the word mother or father, and then they write a line or a sentence starting with each of those words. And so we think of this as being kind of a children's form. But of course, you know, poets have written in this form also. That's what we've been doing. This is so my collaborative partner is this poet, Ryan Scariano, who lives in La Grande, Oregon. We've each been writing an alphabet of poems. So I just wrote a lobster the other day. I've skipped around a little, so I'm about halfway through the alphabet, but I have a vulture and I have a snake and a few from towards the end. And it's the most fun project ever. Yeah.
I hear that you have one of these acrostic poems with you today, or several. Will you read us one?
I would love to. This is one that made me very happy as I was writing it, and I hope it's fun. I think it is. This is my chicken's poem. Cooped overnight in scrap wood and wire, combs tipped frostbite black, my hens hop happy into the crystal sun of minus 10. My Marin, my star, my Rhode Island red, you are a fad. An experiment, a backyard flock. Time for cabbage, cracked corn, time to peck and slurp the winter worm spaghetti. Could I kill you? The cold can't. Are you livestock or pet? You sleep with one eye open, bathe in ashes, lay double yolks. In summer, the yard is yours. My namesakes, you are not chicken. Door open, you enter the kitchen. No threshold stops you. My atavists, my tiny dinosaurs, my fearless, feathered tyrants.
Henrietta Goodman lives in Missoula, Montana. Her other books include Hungry Moon and Take What You Want, which won the Beatrice Holly Award from Alice James Books. Look for more information about her and her work at mtpr.org, where you can also subscribe to our podcast and visit our Facebook page. Many thanks to Humanities Montana for supporting us since 2008, and thanks to you for listening. I'm Sarah Aronson, and this has been The Right Question.
The Right Question is produced by Sarah Aronson, Beth Ann Austin, studio engineer and production assistant. The music in this program was written and performed by John Floridis.